Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We have a rather interesting program today here on Crossover, and it is all about a new opera that has been written by Wendy Steiner with music by Paul Richards and is being premiered at the University of Pennsylvania's Irvine Auditorium on April 1st. I'd like to welcome Wendy Steiner and Paul Richards. Wendy, of course, is the gal that wrote the libretto, I guess you would call it. Is that right, Wendy? Welcome.
That's exactly right. Thank you.
How did this all come about? I mean, it's really rather a unique experience and an exciting foray into the works of Chaucer, I guess.
Yes. Well, everything about it was magical. By pure chance, I had to teach The Wife of Bath's Tale, and it's way out of my field. It was written around 1400, and I normally deal with texts that are written yesterday. And I hadn't looked at this since graduate school. And I read this little story about male-female misunderstanding, and it felt as if I were living my life.
Well, life doesn't change,
Life doesn't change. I mean, every feminist, anti-feminist, counter-feminist, whatever argument was acted out in it, and the plot was so vibrant and tight as a construction that words started popping into my mind and characters started appearing. And before I knew it, I had lyrics, and you know, when I saw them appearing, I started building them into a plot, and it was it turned into a libretto.
Well, had you ever had an idea to write an opera? I mean, was this
I went to the theater a lot in both London and New York, and I also went to the opera, and but I'm an English professor, you know, we don't do this thing normally, but. I do think of opera as the greatest form because it puts so many different other arts together, and produces these wonderful entertainments, of great artistic depth.
So you, is this in Chaucerian English?
No. But, and there are moments when it sort of,
crosses over.
Yeah, well, not quite, but I mean, the word loathly is about as far as it goes in that direction. But it's all in modern English, and it's all parodies of all kinds of different artistic works. The plot of it is just wonderful. And a knight who has raped a maiden and is condemned to death is mercifully given a year and a day to find the answer to the question, what do women want most?
There is no answer to that question.
Yes, there is. Yes, Chaucer said there was. So he goes on a quest, and he talks to many women. And in Chaucer, the problem is that they can't agree. And so he gets to the end of the year and doesn't have an answer, and a loathly lady appears. And the loathly lady is a character who appears all over medieval literature. She says she has the answer, but he has to grant her a wish. And he says, sure. And she says, what women want most is mastery in marriage, which is sort of Chaucer speak for love and self-determination at the same time.
And marriage.
And marriage. Well, at that time, that was the way you said it.
No options, right? Okay.
And so he said, he goes back to court, and this turns out to be the right answer. And then the question is, what is the wish? And she says, I want to marry you. So he is stuck with her. He has no choice at this point. And in bed on their wedding night, which is where the story then goes to, he's quite miserable. And she says, why? And he says, because you're old and ugly. And she says, oh, well, that's no problem. I'll tell you what, I can stay old and ugly as I am, but remain faithful to you, or I can become young and beautiful, but you take your chances. And he thinks for a while and says, you choose. And she's so happy to have mastery in marriage that she becomes young and beautiful and faithful, and they live happily ever after.
Only in the movies.
Only in the Canterbury Tales.
Well, it's a wonderful story. And of course, there is no answer to that because women still don't know what they want. For someone who is not a musician to decide to write an opera is quite a heroic thing.
Well, yeah, I didn't decide to write an opera. I'm telling you that the words, the characters took up, I invented characters who could take up a position within the problem. And that was the key thing. So I invented a character, a lady in waiting to the queen, who the queen is the one who gives him the year and the day. And this character hates men, and so she says, you know, this man will never learn anything. Men can't learn. All they do is, you know, abuse people. And another lady-in-waiting, on the other hand, sort of thinks the knight is quite a dishy guy, and so she is on his side, so they have a little argument together. And so I was able to take a very complicated, puzzling situation and divide the pieces of it up among characters.
Now, how did you search for a composer?
That was really amazing. The libretto sat around for a while because I didn't know any composers. And then I went to a concert and I heard Julianne Baird sing with a recorder player. And her voice and the recorder interacting were so beautiful that I was floored. And I thought, oh, I can't sing, but maybe I could take recorder lessons. So I started doing that. And eventually I told my recorder teacher about this libretto. And he read it. And he saw it as a great opportunity for early instruments. And that if it could be written for early instruments, they would have a kind of comic entertainment, contemporary comic entertainment in which to play. So he told me I had to find a composer or else. And so after asking around, I heard that when you want a composer, you put an ad out.
How do you feel about that, Paul?
Well, you know, we're always looking for opportunities, so this was good.
Okay. That was a very short answer.
It's like you don't want to admit that somebody fixed you up in love or something like that. And this has, it turned out to be an absolutely wonderful collaboration.
Now, Paul, you're a composer of note, many notes, I guess. How did you approach this?
Well, it was such an intriguing possibility. I mean, the reason that I jumped on the opportunity was the opportunity to explore a number of different musical styles. The idea of working with early instruments, which I've always loved, was a fascinating if challenging one. And thankfully, working with a collaborator and working with a text answers a lot of questions for a composer. I mean, I've got a dramatic structure in front of me. I've got a sense of pacing already laid out, and despite this being Wendy's first libretto, it really lays out very well as a libretto. It is quite singable all the way through. There's a lot of opportunity for there's a lot of humor. There's a number of dialogue moments that are quite entertaining, that are speech-like so that they seem natural, but they still sort of warrant being sung, which is a very tricky balance for a librettist. And she just hit the nail on the head, which is the reason that I wanted to take on the task.
Now, the challenge, though, is, of course, you're using Renaissance instruments and, of course, the limitation of those instruments, and also the stylistically, it works perfectly in concept with Chaucerian English or the whole idea, but you as a composer, is this more contemporary? Is this a contemporary approach, or is your music more, how can I say, tonal?
Well, it's, yes, it's tonal. What I've done with this, and this has been an interest in a number of projects, and not just for me, for a lot of contemporary composers, the idea of examining other styles and other musical languages through a contemporary lens is a really intriguing one. And it's an opportunity to make, in this case, a collage of various styles and sounds. And this plays into the idea of the parody and the referential nature of the text. What Wendy's not mentioned yet is that the knight in the quest that he goes on for the year and a day travels throughout time, and he meets iconic characters, Virginia Woolf, Freud, Eliza Doolittle, Scheherazade, a number of these fictional and real persons throughout time, and it gave me an opportunity to try to use instruments and idioms to place the knight in these unfamiliar situations.
Well, also, of course, if you're bringing they are contemporary characters in essence. So certainly Virginia Woolf, I can't imagine her in a Renaissance setting somehow.
Right. No, so what we have is in the scenes that take place in Chaucer's time, we use idioms and instruments from the medieval period, although anachronisms abound, and that's part of the fun of this piece. But when we meet a character like Virginia Woolf, I'm using more contemporary instruments and more contemporary idioms. And the whole thing sort of straddles it straddles boundaries of every kind. In particular, it straddles the boundary between opera and music theater.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted something that was sung through, and the libretto allows for that. But we also wanted part of the attraction of using these early styles and early instruments is that there's kind of an air of familiarity. Even though nobody has heard this before, we're hoping that there's a kind of sense of it plays with your memory. It plays with your expectations of what these other sound worlds are like. And again, that speaks to the idea of this knight finding himself in unfamiliar situations and having to make sense of all these crazy answers that he gets to this penetrating question.
Well, stylistically, it's very structured, though. I mean, Renaissance music certainly is.
Yes, it is. And I had to break rules. Absolutely. There are, there's sort of specific rules for the movements of small things, the movement of one note to another in medieval or Renaissance music, but also larger structural things. And so I've adapted some parameters of the styles and modified others. In other words, at no point does this sound like strictly medieval music. It's a kind of hybrid.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The whole piece is, I guess.
The whole piece is.
Yes, absolutely.
But it also can be, as you said, it can be transferred to modern times. I mean, nothing is really, life doesn't change. The questions don't change, and human beings don't change, and there's always the same problem really going on. It may be said in a different way or with a different accent, but it is still the same problem.
That's exactly right.
Isn't that right?
It is the same problem, but at the same time, the excitement is to see that we can communicate across huge gulfs. If you look at a piece of Chaucer, I can recite a few lines.
Can you please, for the audience?
Okay. This is from the opening of the Canterbury Tales.
That
April with the surer sort of the drucht of March have persed to the rota and bathed every vein in switch liqueur of which virtue engenders the floor. Etc. Etc.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's beautiful, but unless you've got a written text in front of you, which looks a lot more like modern English than it.
But it also sounds like the way when you recited, you can flora, I guess, flower, and when that April something or other,
right.
But it is beautiful. I mean,
it's very
Chaucer
beautiful.
Is
it's
very
poetry.
Beautiful. Yeah, it is poetry.
Yeah.
But again, I guess musically, and it's very musical.
Right. But
yes.
The point
poetry,
is...
Poetry, isn't it? Isn't it?
It is poetry. And I quote little sections of Tennyson when we're dealing with the Lady of Shalott and so on. So, but the point is that these cultural artifacts, which look so foreign, can look so foreign to us nowadays. I mean, the average person is not going to pick up a piece of Chaucer in the original and happily read it. But there is a sameness that goes across time, and a comic sameness, because it's a sameness in difference. And it's the same problem as men and women. There has to be some basis for communication. And on the other hand, there are so many differences of desire, so many differences of expectations. The trick, and it is a kind of magic trick, is to find a point of communication across that. And the whole of the Lovely Lady Project is constructed around that problem of sameness and difference. It has a strong visual component as well, because early on I got the idea that the best way for this opera to be presented would be as an animation, because it's full of, it's a fairy tale in effect,
yes.
and it has many magical characters in it. And I have magnified that magical piece of it in the way that I constructed the libretto. And so a friend of mine, John Kindness, who's an artist in London, I asked him whether he would be willing to draw this, and he did. And so he did many, many drawings of the characters and settings, and I put together a 6.5-minute animation pilot for it. And now, as you can imagine, 6.5 minutes compared to the 100 minutes of the opera, he wasn't able to draw everything that's there. So in order to have stage projections for the concert performance that we're doing, I'm using his still images, and then I've manipulated them with a graphic designer to produce more images to cover the scenes that he didn't cover. And we have a kind of a strange amalgam of, on the one hand, fairy tale visual elements and
live.
Animation and live things on the stage,
yeah,
and
you've
so
covered
on.
Every base.
Yeah,
it's very intellectual too. I think I think it would be a wonderful teaching piece as well, because you're teaching really, you're teaching something, certainly the literature of the period,
right,
and of other periods and other characters. And Paul, how now did you do this long distance, or how did this all work?
Yes, I mean, it's ironic that this piece, based on medieval instruments and medieval text, could not have existed if we didn't have the internet. We have been Wendy and I have spoken by phone, but the vast majority of our communication has been electronic. And as I would complete sections of the music, I would send it to her, sort of computer renderings of things. And it's been long distance. We've met in person a couple of times and become very good friends, but this is really a long distance collaboration for sure.
Now, of course, there's only one performance, isn't that right?
There's one performance scheduled, yes.
Paul, are you going to be there?
Oh, absolutely.
You wouldn't
Absolutely.
Miss it for the world.
Exactly. That's right.
And no computerized music, I hope. And
oh,
I'm
no,
putting myself
no, no.
out on a limb with that one. But
no, this is, we're able to do these sort of poor replicas of things, but the excitement of hearing these actual instruments, and not surprisingly, we have kind of mediocre computer replications of clarinets and violins, but a computer replication of a Krumhorn or a Rebec, those we don't have. So we had the experience of doing this pilot recording where we got these some of the musicians who will be performing on April 1st. We had some of them in the studio, and I had an opportunity to work with them.
They are wonderful, by the way. Oh. Pifaro is a wonderful ensemble. I don't know Parthenia, but they are just stringed instruments. Is that
it's a consort of viola da gambas. And who are based in New York, very fine players who are very innovative in the kind of music that they perform. They're deeply, deeply versed, of course, in the repertoire for early instruments, but many of them play other early instruments or sing. But they create programs that mesh modern music with earlier music as well, and they're contemporary composers who write just for them.
Tell us a little bit about your background, Paul. You're from New York, is that right?
I was born in New York. Lived there all of 6 months, and then we moved around. But it's helpful sometimes as a composer to claim to be a New Yorker.
That's said with a little curl of the lip, I think.
Yeah, yes.
There is nowhere else when you live in New York. They're very provincial.
Right. My father is a cantor and a talented singer, and he composes himself, largely liturgical music. So I grew up in a musical family. I went to school in Arizona, and then my doctorate is from the University of Texas. And I've been teaching at the University of Florida for 10 years now. I teach composition and theory. And my compositions have ranged from symphonies and concerti to small chamber works to vocal works to just about everything. So it seemed like opera was the next thing to try to tackle.
We have a charming disc here, Fables, Forms, and Fears, and the titles are intriguing. A Butterfly Coughs in Africa. Where did that come from?
Well, that particular piece, all of these titles are meant to give a listener some kind of way into the work. All the pieces on this disc are chamber works, and they're not programmatic per se, but I do like the idea that there's an image that you can, or a concept that you can try to bring to your listening experience. Contemporary music can be inaccessible to many people, and I think part of it, the inaccessibility, is simply not having a sense of where the composer was coming from. So that particular work, it's this sort of idea that you get a butterfly flaps his wings in Africa, and somehow that little bit of wind creates a huge storm that comes and hits the coast of South Carolina. And that particular piece is for a massed amount of clarinets, and a small, innocuous gesture at the beginning becomes this torrential storm by the middle.
That also is life, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
In many cases.
Yeah.
So this is a chamber work, and of course now you have this opera to your credit, and what can we look forward to in addition?
Well, Wendy and I, it's a crazy thing when you're involved in artistic production. I finished printing up the 500-page score, you know, which was easily a year's work, and no small amount of work to write an opera. And as the thing was being printed, I was thinking to myself, well, I would do this again. It's just, there's something very compelling about opera. So I imagine that future theatrical works, possibly working with Wendy again, which we've already started discussing, are part of what I'd like to be doing. But I'm pursuing opportunities as they present themselves. Currently completing a saxophone concerto, which sort of couldn't be further in style and medium from the work that we'll be hearing.
Well, Debussy wrote one, so
right,
it wasn't a concerto. I think it was it's a work for saxophone and orchestra. But I think the saxophone was an unusual instrument at the time. They were introducing it into classical music.
It still hasn't found its home, and this work is for saxophone and wind symphony for a saxophone conference in Bangkok this summer.
Wow,
and. You know, it's wonderful to get to do this thing that I feel somehow compelled to do. And the opportunities that I've been pursuing are those that will reach an audience that may not find its way to contemporary music otherwise. Opera is a perfect example of this. I've recently done a film score for a colleague here at the University of Florida, again with this idea of reaching beyond the standard contemporary music concert hall.
I think that film and TV is very, very, a very good medium for contemporary music, because people do not realize when they have visuals in front of them what's going on musically. They wouldn't listen in many cases to the music in a concert hall that they listen to coupled with some kind of visual experience. And I have said that many times speaking with groups, that if you were in the kitchen when the television was on and you heard some of the musical scores, you would never, never listen to them. You would never even bother. But it's a wonderful introduction, because we are still introducing the public to contemporary music. It takes about, 100 years, you think?
It may. And I think that what I'm doing and what many of my colleagues are doing is probably more instantly accessible and approachable than some of the things that may have been done 30, 40 years ago. Just aesthetics have changed. But you're absolutely correct that having a visual component or a narrative component helps people understand why this music may be doing things that are scary, unfamiliar, whatever sort of situation is happening. It also occurred to me in the course of working on this that many of the musical innovations that have changed musical style throughout time have been associated with vocal music and opera in particular. I mean, Monteverdi is a perfect example.
All right.
And even the sort of change to atonality 100 years ago was in part associated with vocal music.
Yes, well, some of the very early vocal music is rather, well, unusual, I think, to the ear of the I guess, the conservative listener, let's put it that way.
But you accept it. Right, you do, because you understand the text. There's a reason behind these unusual sounds.
But also, if you listen to medieval music,
yes,
it's surprisingly, it sounds surprisingly syncopated and jazz-like at times. And that was one of the thoughts that was behind this as well.
Well, it was dance music, a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was
That's
the
correct.
Music of the people. But also the intervals, you know, of church music, the early ones that were forbidden after we got into a more, I guess, more westernized, you know, harmonic structure, those are accepted now, and of course, I guess contemporary music uses them. But there is that also sense of I guess a modal sound or an early sound, early in quotes, of course. Well, it's fascinating, wonderful to speak with both of you, and we can't wait to see the premiere of The Loathly Lady on April 1st at Penn. Thank you so much for coming to Crossover.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jill.
Bye-bye.